Kripali Tajura is a cancer doctor with an incredible spirit. As a radiation oncologist, she sees patients with potentially terminal cancer and embraces both their fears and their aspirations around these very difficult diagnoses, with an overflowing compassion and kindness that more resembles something you'd expect from their dearest friends. She's moved to find ways to bring joy and fulfillment into their challenging journeys. As an outlet for some of the beauty and struggle she faced every day, she started blogging and organically attracting an audience who was moved to serve her patients as she was. When she found social media, this was taken to a whole new level as her raw honesty and genuine care began catalyzing an international group of followers who were moved to do small acts that sometimes added up to fulfillment of major life wishes for her patients, from Andre Rieu concerts to being on the Ellen Show to attending Steelers games and more. On a personal level, she's one of my friends who really enlivens my hope for humanity. Simultaneously, incredibly accomplished, yet astonishingly humble, fully committed to her work without compromising on her priority for family and friends, and unmistakably grounded and balanced in the face of things that would unsettle most people. Kripali, thanks so much for being here to share your stories and journey.
Thank you so much for inviting me to be here today.
Yes. Birju will also be co-moderating with me, but the first question I sort of had for you, Kripali, was I know that your father is a physician and your mom is also in the medical field and that you're very close to both of them, but I was curious to know what drew you to follow in their professional footsteps and, in particular, why you chose the specialty that you did.
Well, growing up, my father's a pediatrician, and I sort of grew up in his office helping my mom bill, things of that nature. But I think service has always been a big part for them as well. They volunteer in medical camps in India, and so while growing up, I noticed how much help they were giving to other people, and I think that's what sort of attracted me to medicine in general. And the particular field, that happened sort of by circumstances. When I was in medical school, my mom's oldest sister was diagnosed with cancer, and having her go through it sort of opened my eyes to that field a little more, and my interest grew further after that.
Now, you have so many stories around people's final wishes sort of reaching fulfillment. Is there a story you could share that stands out as one that particularly moved you the most, and either the one that you experienced with your aunt that really inspired this journey, or one from someone that was one of your patients?
Oh, there's so many. It's hard to choose. I'll start with the story that actually brought forth this journey. I started a special support group called the Ruby Red Slippers for some female patients of mine, and we would get together for dinner once a month or so just to discuss life, play games, and just chat. Nothing about cancer, but just sort of interacting amongst one another. And there was a young lady there. She was diagnosed with stage 4 cancer at the age of 30, which is fairly young. And so we became fairly close since we were similar in age. And she once looked at me, she said, it would be fun to go to the Ellen Show. And so I said, let's get tickets. We'll go online, request tickets just like normal people do. And we tried to do that, and they were unavailable for the entire season. Knowing that she didn't have too much time on her hands, I called the show personally, but they said, sorry, we can't do anything. Good luck. Try next year. Even though I explained the circumstances. So I'd recently gotten on Twitter, and I honestly didn't understand Twitter. I would just, think of real big status updates in fast time. But I just threw that request out there. I said, if anybody has connections to get tickets to the Ellen Show for a patient, let me know. And a person, a stranger, I had never met her, replied, and he said, I've been a makeup artist in the industry for over 20 years. I've never asked for a favor, but on behalf of you, I'm going to ask. And 2 weeks later, we got VIP tickets to go to the show. And when I got those tickets, the joy that it gave her, it was incredible. It sort of gave her hope. And taking her to the show and, you know, and it experiencing it with her, sort of, I sort of understood the power a little bit more of social media and how strangers could get more involved in the lives of my patients.
Did we lose you, Kripali? Are you still there?
I'm here. Can you hear me?
Okay. Yes.
Yeah.
I didn't know if that was a pause or if that was the end of the story. But so it was sort of like now the woman who started this, was she a patient or just a member of the group?
The woman who started.
The woman who you took to the Ellen show from the Ruby Red
Slippers. She was a patient. She was a patient of mine.
Yeah. Well, one of the things that's really fascinating to me is, you know, I hear about how the medical profession sort of teaches doctors to remain at a sort of a professional distance from from patients. And, you know, even from this very first, you know, idea and inspiration that you had about holding a support group, it sort of very much flies in the face of that traditional guidance. And you obviously took it many steps further with, you know, personally reaching out and connecting to this woman and trying to fulfill that wish. I'm curious to hear how you, just sort of how you processed the message that was coming from the medical profession and what really moved you to sort of go against that grain.
I think I've always gone against the grain, per se. Even in residency, the director took me aside and told me that I cared too much about, or I didn't care enough about the technology and I cared too much about my patients, which I thought was very sad. It's difficult. It's not always easy to go against the grain. I've been told that I will burn out. But, you know, I'm human. It's sort of, you know, when I always look at patients and, you know, what if that was me? What if that was my parent? What if that was my brother or sister? You know, if you humanize it in that way, it's hard not to get connected, you know. And how do I deal with that emotionally and how can, you know, process it? I blog or I write. And that's sort of my catharsis or my release from the situation at times when it does get painful, because eventually most of my patients do end up, you know, passing on. And that's hard. You know, when I was a resident, I had to do a pediatric 3-month rotation and to see little kids with cancer. That was, I would come home crying every day. And when you see a little kid and you trade baseball cards with him, and then 2 weeks later, he doesn't come in anymore and you know why, that's hard.
Mm. Yeah.
But if you could make their last month or, you know, and bring them a little joy, how can you not give them joy?
Right.
Because I think their joy also helps their families and loved ones feel a little joy too. Because it's not only the patient who gets affected with the disease, but, you know, it's their family members and their loved ones who care about them also.
Right.
And I just don't understand how you can't. That's just, you know, and I don't have an answer per se, but I just don't understand how you can't connect.
Right. You know, I've also heard, you know, studies on the very opposite case, that the thing that sort of really leads to burnout is that that advice to stop your natural feelings of empathy, which actually ends up sort of being more emotionally difficult than sort of fully processing and dealing with the emotions that are just a natural part of being human. I'm wondering if you ever tried doing it the other way and if you have any particular insights about, you know, that relationship between the compassion and the empathy with the sustainability of maintaining that emotional connection.
So if I've ever tried not to connect, is that what you're asking?
Yeah, did you ever try following the standard advice?
The standard guidelines? I did, I think, when I was a resident. But it was hard it was too difficult. It was hard. It was harder than to care. You know, I had some great relationships with some of these patients even during residency and even as a medical student. And it's just, it's the natural being. So I just tried to go with my sense of normalcy, what I found normal.
Right.
And sort of process it that way. But I tried before in medical school and residency not to care or not to get as close, but it didn't work. I wasn't happy, and if I wasn't happy, I wasn't doing service to others anyhow.
Yeah. If you had to sort of categorize what people want most from these difficult situations, what types of things do you see that they are looking for, whether or not they're things that you can provide?
A lot of them just want to feel loved. Most of them just want to spend quality time with their loved ones, whoever that may be. And they just want to make, they try to want to make certain that everything, after they pass, they, you know, things will be okay for their families, whether it be financial, emotional, et cetera. I think the fundamental want from everybody is love. And need.
How do you, I mean, do you ever feel sort of emotional fatigue? And, you know, do you ever, how is it, how, what is it that you do to sort of reactivate that energy in yourself to be able to reach out and love your patients?
I read, I sleep, I go to the gym, I write, and I try to sort of disconnect a little bit, a few hours during the week, just to sort of re-energize my spirit and being.
What have been some of the reactions that you've seen to the acts of kindness that you've been a part of, either in the patient's families or just in the broader Twitter sphere, on your blog? Anywhere.
Oh, the reaction has been amazing from the families. You know, there was a woman that I was treating with terminal brain cancer, and her husband and her four children, her four daughters, would bring her in, you know, for their therapy. And I would hug all the girls and talk to them because, you know, they were losing their mother and they knew this. And they would come into my office crying and I'd be their shoulder. And she passed away on a Thursday, and they had her service a week later. But that Monday morning, they all came in, the four girls and her husband, with a dozen roses for me. And I was taken aback because I didn't understand what was going on. And they just said, you know, we just wanted to let you know that we appreciate you caring and loving our mother during her final week and caring for us. And it's sort of common, right? It has become, fortunately, you know, after people lose their loved ones, they come back to say thank you, which has been, you know, it's very humbling because you're put in the situation which you wish you never had to be in, but it's they're very grateful. And I think with the stuff that has gone on with the social media, networking and the dreams that have been fulfilled by strangers for people that they don't even know, it's just been incredibly overwhelming and very powerful. And to understand that people in the world are good, which sometimes we don't really see or tend to believe, people in the world do care, which is really enlightening, and they do want to help even strangers, which is just, that in itself, I think, makes me feel, you know, recharged and happy and energized, wanting to do more if possible. Because I think that kindness does have a rippling effect. When I share some of my stories with others, I get emails or messages that, you know, I wanted to do some good too, and this is what I did. And I told my coworkers who are now helping other people in, you know, X, Y, and Z fashion. And I think it's just sort of a rippling effect that kind of re-energizes naturally.
Yeah, it's amazing how the change in outlook from believing that no one cares to believing that everyone cares and wants to help really just makes a 180-degree shift in sort of how we move through the world. I'm curious on how that approach, that switch that you made, has impacted either your own staff or the other physicians that you sort of work closely with. You know, have there been any changes in how they work or their general outlook after you started doing
this? Yeah, you know, there's a particular story I wanted to share. I had an elderly lady I was taking care of, and it was close to Christmas, Thanksgiving time. So I asked her what she was doing for the holidays, and she said, nothing, you know, I live alone. You know, so I said, well, what are you going to do on Christmas? And she goes, I'll probably cut my birthday cake alone. I was born on Christmas, and she just sort of looked down, and I said, okay, well, I was going to be away during Christmas time on holiday, but I said, you know, what flavor cake do you like? I'll bring one to your house a week before, and we'll celebrate together. And she didn't believe me. So I said, no, what's your favorite flavor? And we chatted a little bit, and then I just looked at her, and I said, well, if you had one dream, what would it be? And she looked down, and she smiled, and she giggled. Like, I'd love a surprise birthday party, but, you know, being born on Christmas, I never got one. And so I laughed with her, and she goes, and then she's like, well, I'm a little too old for it. And she was going to be 65 or 67, I can't recall. And I said, yeah, you're too old. And when she left that day, I told my staff, I said, we're going to throw her a surprise birthday party. And Rahul, your sister also participated in this event as well. And so what happened was it was incredible generosity. So right after she left, I told my staff, and, you know, the nurses and the therapists were like, okay. I go, we're going to throw her a birthday party. I don't know how. I don't know, but we're going to figure it out. Like, don't worry. So I put it out on Facebook. I said, you know, next patient dream is a birthday party, surprise birthday party. And a friend or two emailed me, and they said, you know, we want to financially help. And I said, no. And then they said, no, we want to send a check. So they sent a check. And a girl that I hadn't seen since elementary school on Facebook sent me a message. She goes, you know, I saw your post. I know what you do. I'd love to donate my services. Can you give me the color scheme and the flavor of cake? I want to, you know, bake her a cake. And then I run a tumor board in the hospital. One of the tumor board participants said, well, you're throwing this party. Can I bring the flowers? And, you know, the Ruby Red Slipper group I told, so they were like, can we come to the party and bring our kids? And I said, sure. I told former patients, current patients, and some doctors were like, can we bring the balloons? And, you know, we had it at a local pizza parlor, and when I brought this patient in, she was just so overwhelmed with love, and, you know, she was so excited that this was for her. I had also invited a high school class to come, which they did, and they made her this beautiful banner. And she had never celebrated her birthday like this, and for her to feel loved, people brought little gifts and knickknacks. It was incredible to see. And not only was that part incredible, but what was even more touching to me was out of the high school kids that had come, one of the girls came up to me. She was 16, and she started crying, and she said, thank you, Dr. DeJura, for inviting me to this. And, you know, I was like, no, I'm just glad that you guys got to come. It was in the middle of their finals week to take the time to come celebrate with a stranger. And the words which were prophetic for me was, you know, until today, I didn't know how much my presence meant to someone. And I thought that was very transformative for this young girl to know that, you know, her presence does matter, whether it be at a stranger's birthday party, you know, whatever it may be. And also my staff, who had never really truly participated, they had all come. And they still talk about it to this day, 2 to 3 years out, that, you know, that was actually really neat. And from then on, they've really noticed that if a patient is in need or has a wish or does something, they always let me know because we'll try to figure out how to make it happen. So I think it's also transformed in their way, their view of, you know, going a little bit above and beyond. We can make a difference because they'll never forget that woman's smiling face celebrating that birthday and how much joy we gave to her.
Wow, that's wonderful. I'm smiling just hearing that story. I mean, it just feels like the office has just been converted into, you know, co-conspirators in the goodness that you're putting out there. It's so beautiful.
It is brilliant.
What's been the reaction of other other professionals, you know, other physicians who don't...
I sort of, honestly, I keep it under the radar. The people I work with, I don't think really understand. So I think there's just these...
I think it's just someone laughing.
Oh, okay, yeah, they don't really get it, and that's fine. I'd rather just kind of fly under the radar, do my thing, and I think that's the best way that works for me. You know,
well,
the staff knows and they help out, but the superiors don't, and that's okay.
But I'm curious, why did you feel like it was better to fly under the radar? Did you feel like they wouldn't be?
I don't think they would be as supportive, to be honest.
And is it because of they either have sort of superior responsibilities, or is it because it violates that fundamental tenet of professional distance?
Detaching from the patient. I think it's the fundamental, you must detach from the patient. As I was told even during training, I care too much about the patient, not enough about the technology. And I think that's...
Can I jump in there for a second?
Sure, go ahead, Birju.
I'm really intrigued there in terms of what you're saying in how to share across not only with the patients but with the doctors as well. Do you think there's an opportunity there to start changing minds and hearts in the institutions that you're a part of?
Sure. I work in a small little private group, so it's harder. They're already, like, I think they're pretty old, so their minds are set. But I think sharing these stories with medical students and people who are getting training now, it could be more transformative. I think it's medical education, per se, that needs to sort of change a little bit.
Is there room for a kindness curriculum in medical school?
Yeah, there should be. I wish there was. You know, people are kind, but I think it's that doctor-patient, you know, boundary that people are afraid of sort of blurring.
You know, I've also heard my other friends who are doctors say that you know, being a doctor is their act of sort of kindness, compassion for the world. And I know that a lot of people get into the medical field with those kinds of noble professions as well. Yeah, it does sound like that advice that's given in medical training is what keeps the distance. What advice do you have about there may be medical students listening right now. What's the advice that you would have about keeping that connection alive and how to gently sort of fly in the face or at least experiment with an alternative approach to see what works best for them?
I mean, I always say, imagine the patient to be a loved one of yours, and how would you like to be treated? You know, I've had friends or family in the hospital, and sometimes when I see how the doctors or people treat them, I get pretty upset because that's not the way I would want them to be treated. So how would you want to be treated? I think if you sort of keep that perspective in mind, the kind of care that you do give can change. We forget to put ourselves in those shoes at times. In whatever profession that we do, you know, what would it be like walking in their shoes? And if we kind of keep that at bay, I think we would act differently.
Okay. You know, I want to sort of rewind a little bit. I just recently became a parent, and I'm really... You know, I'm surrounded by so many incredible examples of just outrageous generosity and compassion and kindness, and I really want my daughter to sort of grow up believing in a world that's so fundamentally good, and you know, I want her to fearlessly be kind and to be giving. And so I'm sort of curious about what your parents did to create conditions that allowed that empathy and compassion to sort of flourish in you.
They are, and they still are very giving people. They always told us the importance of service to others, whether it be volunteering in India, to volunteering in the local community, food banks and whatnot. Service projects were always fundamental to us growing up and helping the community out in whichever way, shape, or form. And they were always very supportive, very loving, and very kind in whatever activities or whatever crazy ideas my brother and I had growing up, which I thought was great. Even today, they do service projects. They go to Africa. They're going to Russia this summer to help out in a medical camp. And that spirit is still there. And I think they inspire me to become better and to help more and do more. They lead with good examples, I think. And I was just blessed to have that, I think.
So given that strong emphasis on service that, has been a part of their professional career and is clearly part of yours, I'm curious about how you think of that professional-personal divide, especially with how much you care with your patients. I mean, is there a fundamental difference between the things that we do that we're compensated for and the things that we do that there is no clear reward for or direct reward for that has a fundamental impact on how we feel about what we're doing?
Not understanding your question per se.
There's an aspect of, I'm stepping back a little bit into the question that I asked previously about how some of my other friends who are physicians really believe that just the act of being physician is an act of service, and there isn't any additional work to be done beyond that, sort of above and beyond the call of their basic duty. And what I get from you is that, all of these things like the pizza party and, the getting on the Ellen show, these really are things that are, they are above and beyond the call of duty, and no one is really paying you to do that, right? No one is saying that this is part of your job, Kripali. So I guess I want to hear if you have any reflections on how doing something that is sort of selfless, in the sense that you aren't getting paid for it, makes a difference in either the quality of intention or the quality of feeling that you get from doing it.
I think doing what you said is above and beyond helps me also deal personally, I think. It may be a little selfish in the fact that it helps me feel that I've done something to hopefully make their life a little better and help me eventually deal with that patient's loss a little easier. Does that make sense?
Can you elaborate?
Not really. I haven't really thought about it, so it's kind of hard to put into words. I don't know, if you, not really. I'm still not understanding the question. So it's like, why do I go above and beyond, or how can you...
Going above and beyond make it more emotionally rewarding?
Yes. It does. It kind of, it does make it a little more rewarding if you see somebody smile because they're surprised that they see something that they never expected in a million years. Of course, it's just like surprising a friend or a family with something. It's emotionally rewarding whether you're a doctor or just another human being helping out. There's no real differentiation. I'm just given that, it's sort of being a doctor in the profession that I do, and I'm sure in any profession that you do, there's always an opportunity to help somebody, whether it be a coworker, whether it be, you know, an engineer that you're working with, whatever. But there's always an opportunity to help. I think I'm just sort of trying to take that opportunity and run with it if I can.
Mm. Right.
I don't think it's because I'm a physician, or, you know, I don't think it's job specific.
Right. So you're saying we all essentially have that opportunity, and even
your coworker, your secretary, or whoever. You know, it's like if the secretary is like, "Oh, my son's really ill," or, you know, what if somebody has a serious medical issue and they're having difficulty paying the bills, whatever it may be. You know, there's always an opportunity to help, whether it be helping do a fundraiser, whatever it is, or doing a bake sale. I mean, there's always opportunities out there. I think you just have to figure out a way to see them and find them if you want to help out.
Right.
It's wonderful. Rahul, I was wondering on that wonderful note if we should start Q&A. Since we have a lot of callers today,
sure.
I want to make sure everybody gets an opportunity. Yeah?
Sure.
Is that okay?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
Yeah, okay. Thank you so much, Krupali. So what we are going to do now is start the Q&A session. And if you have a question, just hit *6 and you will be put in the queue. And Rahul or Birju, you can ask a question while we wait for people to join the call.
You know, actually, Gunjan, I was going to jump in.
Sure.
And, you know, Krupali, thank you again for sharing so many just beautiful stories. I was wondering if you had come across instances in which, you know, something didn't work out, where you had tried very hard to fulfill a patient's dream and it didn't work out, and kind of how you sort of processed that, you know, and, you know, because after you've, you know, sometimes after you've developed so much success and in being able to do this, there's sometimes a high that kind of comes with it, and you do feel good, but then, you know, when you aren't able to come through, then there's potentially the opportunity for serious disappointment. So I'm just kind of curious about an instance where you've come across that.
So there was an instance recently where a young lady and her family, their wish was to go to Disneyland. And we tried to make it happen, and we almost did. But when we called with the plan, she was too ill to go. And it is a little disappointing, and it's a little sad, but I think even the thought of her wanting to go into the kink sort of gave her hope, and I just kind of have to take comfort in that fact. And sometimes the plans don't work out. But I sort of have to rationalize that at least we tried. And I think that in itself is of value.
Yeah.
And yeah, you do get disappointed, but it's okay.
So sort of related to that question, Krupali, before we launch into the queue, I wanted to hear more about how you think about intention and trust, because I've heard you share stories about, you know, in the middle of caring for a patient or just planning something for them, that, you know, there were moments where you just sort of placed the intention correctly and then somehow reached a sense of serenity or maybe even certainty about the outcome before it manifested. So I want to hear your thoughts about, you know, intention and trust and just sort of how to your feeling around how to intensify the best of our intentions in the world to give them the best chances of manifesting.
I've seen it time and time again, but if you have a selfless thought for somebody else, it usually works out. From strangers, whatever it may be. I had a patient who wanted to go, or actually it wasn't even a patient of mine, who wanted to see the Steelers play. They didn't have the money to fly to see the Pittsburgh Steelers. They had, you know, and I said, let's figure it out. And my nurse said, how? And I go, I don't know, but we will figure it out, okay? I don't know how, but it's going to work. And in the end, if I have to buy the ticket for them and whatnot, that's okay, we'll figure it out. But in the end, we had tickets donated, we had, you know, game tickets, and Lynn Swann, the Hall of Famer, came to meet them. It just worked. And even with simple things, you know, another story is I had a woman, and she wanted to spend time with her family in a cabin in the mountains where I practice. And I knew that her family couldn't afford it. So I asked around, people were willing to donate money, but then a nurse asked a friend of his who had a cabin, and this is a woman I have yet to meet. I don't know her, but she called me up and she goes, I understand you need a cabin for a patient. Can I donate my cabin for a week? Like, how many people are going to let a stranger and her family stay in their, you know, it was just beautiful. And it was just, and you just know, I don't know how it just, it's hard to explain, but it's sort of, you know, if a person needs something and you have the means of spreading the word out, it will happen. You just have to have trust in that. I don't know. It just is. It's hard to, I mean, how can you explain that? It just is. The world has a way of working out. And that in itself, like, I sometimes have to sit back and wonder in awe. Like, I don't understand it, but I'm just going to let it happen.
Beautiful.
And I'm not going to analyze it. Just let it be. Because I think analyzing it kind of ruins. I'm kind of a simple thinker. It just is.
Mm.
That's beautiful. Rahul, should I have the caller?
Yes. Yes, please. Go ahead.
Hi, this is Anne Marie from New York City. Can you hear me?
Yeah, yes.
Hi. First of all, I just want to thank Rahul and Birju and all of you guys there and for having this call, and Kripali for being on this call. It's been a tremendous blessing to listen to this. I'm a nurse currently at a hematology oncology clinic, and I just want to say I wish there were more doctors like you out there. It's really heart-opening to hear you speak. And I just to touch on something that was asked earlier about, you know, this thought of a kindness curriculum. You know, so often I hear the patients and their parents. I work in pediatrics, but, you know, the parents on behalf of the kids who are going through these difficult times with their care, you know, hoping that their physicians would see them as, you know, not just a patient, but as a human being. And I just feel like what you're doing is really inspiring, and I would hope that more of your colleagues could benefit from your insight and your experiences. And I don't know if there's an opportunity to possibly, you know, have grand rounds or these conferences in which, you know, they could be inspired by that. I feel you very much when you say that you're under the radar, because I do that myself with even my own nursing colleagues sometimes. But I've seen at times when I have kind of, you know, just sprouted out and tried to be me in that moment and do these random acts of kindness and just, you know, touch another heart, that those ripples have, you know, kind of rippled out, and my colleagues have kind of taken that and ran with it as well. So I was wondering if you'd be open to, you know, maybe not being so under the radar.
It's so nice to be under the radar, though.
Well, you know that this is getting recorded and the blog and audio will be posted after this. So.
I just want to say, if there's anything I can do, I will absolutely be there to help you in any way I can, because I think what you're doing is absolutely beautiful. And like I said, there should be more physicians and doctors like you, because, you know, you guys have this tremendous opportunity to not only heal the disease process, but the soul and the heart. So I offer myself.
But Anne-Marie, do you know who runs the hospital and who knows more than all the doctors combined are the nurses. So I just want to say thank you for doing what you do.
Well, thank you. It's a co-creative process, you know, and So
because when I have trouble, who do I go to? I go straight to the nurses. So I just want to say thank you.
Well, thank you. Thank you for being on this call. And I hope to share this with all my colleagues and the physicians as well. So.
Very kind.
So thank you.
Thank you. Just to kind of make sure that we're looking at the other side too, Krupali, I was wondering, I grew up in India, I went to school in India, and in India it's different, like the parents pay for your education. And I can empathize with people who grew up here because, you know, I've heard that you have to take a lot of loans and you go to medical school for so many years before you can actually start practicing. So do you think like that has some impact on, because you know, it's weighing on your mind that you need to pay back your loans and you kind of tend to, you know, do you think that has some impact on why doctors are not giving so much time or, you know, you have these 15-minute appointment slots?
No, it has not. You know, I think, I don't know if you guys saw the time piece on the bitter pill. I think medicine in general needs a revamp.
Mm-hmm.
People, you know, if you're working in an HMO or a Kaiser or whatnot, you have to see a certain amount of patients in a certain amount of time. You're put under the gun.
Yeah.
It just depends on the mode that you practice in. I don't think it's the loans and all that are on the mind. It's more of the people breathing down your neck saying, how many did you see, how many did you not see, how long did you spend? I mean, and fortunately where I work, I'm not under that gun, which is it's a blessing because I don't know if I could do that. But a lot of people I know are in that sort of, you know, 9:15 to 9:30 is one. You know, it's just, and I think the entire model of medicine needs to change. And I don't think D.C. or Washington or the lobbyists or the people, they don't know what's going on. And I think they're the wrong people to be put in charge. But that's my own personal opinion.
Yeah. No, that article was interesting. Thank you so much.
It was interesting. Yeah.
Yeah.
Krupali, this is Mark from Vancouver. I have two, more than a, it's not exactly a question, it's two comments that I'd like your feedback on. The first is the idea that all your endeavors should really be happily paid for by insurance companies and managed care programs, because really what you're doing is transforming palliative care. You're just taking it an extra step, right? You're taking it beyond the physical and into addressing the emotional needs of dying patients. So certainly our insurance companies would be more than happy to underwrite all this, I would think. That's my first comment.
I've never asked or tried. It's all okay.
But isn't there this notion that essentially you're taking palliative care to its logical extreme?
I guess so, or I'm doing the make-a-wish for adults. I mean, there's two ways of looking at it.
Okay, my second comment is a story, and it has I guess I'm encouraging you like others not to fly under the radar. My sister is a hospitalist, and when she was a resident at CPMC in San Francisco, one of the families that she had to inform that their family member had died were standing in the lobby of the hospital, and this was a family she liked a lot. And of course, they started to cry. She started to cry. They were embracing her. She was embracing them. And as this was going on, one of the senior attendings in the hospital walked by, saw this, was absolutely outraged, and stormed up to the office of the guy who ran the residency program there, and through clenched teeth and just with all the anger he could muster, screamed at this guy, "This is simply not done in this hospital." And ordered him to reprimand my sister. So he called my sister up and he said, "You know, I was thinking about this, and you know, this doctor is right. This isn't done in this hospital." And I got to thinking, you know, why isn't it done? So my suggestion is that sometimes flying under the radar, not necessary. You just have to be visible to the right people.
How's your sister doing now? Where is she?
She's in Walnut Creek, and she's doing well.
Oh, good.
Still crying with the occasional family member.
And that's okay. I've cried too. How can you not? I mean, yeah.
Thank you, Mark.
Hi, my name is Gina, and it's great to hear Kripali. Thank you so much for inviting her and Kripali for speaking. I had an experience yesterday that I wanted to share and then also just briefly comment on what other people have said. So I'm a family doctor by training. I'm not practicing at the moment. I'm doing mostly research. And I was on the bus going in Oakland actually to purchase the ticket. So I was riding AC Transit, and a woman had a swollen ankle. And she was a little bit drunk, and she was very loudly talking to some of the other passengers around her. And she was explaining why she had been drinking, and it turns out she had fallen on her ankle, and she was trying to dull the pain. So it happened that I had an ACE wrap, and it happened that I had ibuprofen with me because ibuprofen I carry anyway for myself, and ACE wrap, somebody else at work was talking about a swollen ankle, and so I thought maybe I would give it to her next time I saw her. So I talked to this woman, and I gave her the ibuprofen and gave her the ACE wrap, and some of the other passengers were kind of looking curiously at me. And this woman's friend turned to me and said, "Hey, are you a doctor?" And I didn't actually want to admit that I was. So I said, "Oh, I just carry this for myself." And then I mentioned where I was going, and actually some of the passengers tried to kind of direct me and help me figure out where I needed to go for this ticket protest. And then because I mentioned the thing about the ticket, her friend said, "Are you a lawyer?" So they were really trying to place me in why I was doing what I was doing. And this kind of echoed for me what some of the other people were saying earlier in the call about people kind of questioning, who are you? Why are you doing something that you don't have to do? But for me, it was also interesting. I didn't want to admit that I was a doctor while I was doing this, because for me, sort of being off duty, I didn't want people to think that I am trying to push medicine or I'm trying to sort of do something that is part of my profession. Like, I just wanted to be incognito, I guess, in a way, under the radar in my own way. But I wanted to say that some of the issues that people have been bringing up, like about doctors maybe wanting to maintain emotional distance and having time constraints, may be real problems for why they can't imagine doing this more. And it's not necessarily who they are as people, but it may be the feelings that they have about how they could deal with time, how they are already feeling overwhelmed by the business side of medicine, and their own emotional capacity. So I encourage, Kripali, you to keep talking to medical students, to try to make it to grand rounds, and to keep working on us. I mean, I think us as people in the medical profession, I think we need stories. We need to hear what you said about when you really have a good intention, other people and life circumstances will help you make it happen, and we'll be able to overcome whatever emotional or time barriers we might have.
No pressure, Kripali.
You know, when I sit, like when I have lunch in the doctor's lounge or at the hospitals that I'm in and I do share my stories, you know, most of these doctors who are older, usually they get so happy and they're like, you know, we need to hear more of the good. And I think a lot of the doctors or people in the medical business in general don't hear the good. And I think that could potentially be beneficial and inspiring for other doctors or, you know, other professionals in the healthcare industry to do good. It has become a business, and I think that's what makes it very difficult to draw the line of, you know, who you are as a human and then the business side of things.
Thank you.
You know, Kripali, this is Amit. I'm sorry to just jump in on that note, but perhaps you can type up some of these stories and maybe you can leave anonymous newsletters in the doctor's lounge for people to read about what some other doctors are doing elsewhere. And perhaps
that's a great idea.
Ripple out into something.
Yeah.
Exactly. This is Prakash. What Amit said, I was thinking along those lines in terms of, you know, there is something called anonymous. So that's the beautiful answer to your under the radar work and to amplify this beautiful work. And I also feel like this this should reach wide and far and wide, especially in the caregiver the spaces. The doctor, this talk really brought a lot of hope and joy. I'm really looking forward to our maybe the next doctor's visit, and with the hope that we will run into a caregiver like you. And when I say you, you and your what makes you, your team, and all the invisible people around you who help channel this beautiful act of you know, the joy and bringing that maybe it is one last mile in the people. So my question is around something I heard on the radio that I was thinking a little bit to seeing the really the stress on the people who really are the key caregivers, especially I think in America.
Mm-hmm.
So and the statistics that this program put out is like the lifespan of the doctors in America is statistically quite alarming, and more so I think the lifespan of the doctors here when compared to other countries, is compared quite pale. So I was wondering if you had some thoughts around it, and the other part of the question is, do you have one or two wish for change in the patients? Maybe that would be something that I will be more mindful and aware next time when I go and see the doctor, and so that we can make the doctors and the caregivers feel more loved and belonged. Thank you.
So the first part of your question was what? I'm sorry? The lifestyle of the doctor in America?
Right.
Lifespan, right, Prakash?
That's
for the caregiver.
Prakash, I think she's trying to understand what the first part of your question was, where you would ask, you're comparing the lifestyle or the lifespan of doctors in America versus doctors abroad.
That's right. Okay, let me clarify. The lifespan of doctors in America.
And are you saying, was this study saying that it's longer or
shorter? It is much shorter.
I honestly don't have any comments on it, since I don't really know the major differences in the lifestyle here versus other countries.
Yeah, that's fine. We can go to the second part. Oh, what can we as patients do to make doctors' life more easy and kind of show compassion to the doctors who are taking care of us?
That's you know what I do teach my patients, and I just gave a lecture on this last week, is always be your own advocate, especially in the healthcare field. Don't be afraid to question your doctor. I know doctors who wear white coats, it can be a little intimidating, but always ask questions, you know, and in certain cases when things are serious or you have to maybe, you know, have a surgery done or something serious done, always get another opinion or two. There's nothing wrong, and doctors won't feel bad if you say, you know, I want to get a second opinion on something. I feel as being a patient, you should always be your own advocate or have somebody advocate for you. And to show compassion, I think, you know, advocating for yourself is compassion of taking care of your own self, which is very, you know, commendable.
Wow. That's beautiful.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kripali.
Hi, Kripali. My name is Ilyas. I'm from Oakland. I just wanted to offer some resources for you that you're probably already aware of, but I thought are right up your alley. One is, I'm sure you're familiar with the work of Rachel Naomi Remen, and she's connected with the foundation, an organization out here called Commonweal that provides a lot of incredible programs and does a lot of end-of-life care. And she has a really extraordinary story, and you can, she has some books out, and there are videos and interviews of her. So she created a class in medical school called The Art of the Healer. And apparently now it's in most medical schools in the U.S., and it's the one of, it is the most popular class in medical school. And she's basically trying to bring in that re-education, and it's essentially to claim, reclaim, or reestablish medical space as sacred space, and shifting the conversation back from medicine as, you know, management of illness to something far deeper and far greater. And so she's part of this community that, that is real and exists, you know, of healthcare practitioners who are really trying to revive medicine as a sacred science and, a, and an art. And Andrew Weil also has his program of integrative medicine, where he basically, you know, the way I would frame it is he rehabilitates physicians to think holistically in a program that is primarily for doctors, where they sort of integrate their knowledge and get a bigger perspective about how to care for their patients. So those are just a few things out there that are quite extraordinary, that I would, you know, I would recommend. And I think there would be, I would imagine there would be a lot of opportunities for you to get support in doing the great work that you're doing, and to get sort of the knowledge download from some of those that have come before us, and, you know, to stand on their shoulders and know that, wow, there is a community of practitioners out there. They have thought about this for decades. They have applied it. And they're slowly, you know, one heart at a time, trying to change the course of, you know, a system that is so dominated by money. And if, and I can email you links and titles and excuse me, I can email you links and titles if you, you know, I can catch you offline.
That would be wonderful. Thanks for sharing those two people's names. That would be beneficial to me. Thank you so much.
You're welcome. You're welcome. And I also, I'll send that out to you. I'll get your contact information from whoever I would get that from.
I'll send it to you.
Okay, Kanchan. Thank you. Thank you. So part of my own work you're welcome. Part of my own work is to essentially, you know, I'm sort of a part of that conversation to, you know, restore the role of physician as healer and not just as technician. And I'm, it was really touching to know that there's that you are out there doing what you're doing, and I would echo the thoughts of some of the listeners who mentioned that, you know, that that there are some ways in which you could probably engage the resources. Yeah, I mean, I really believe, and I think you would probably agree, that the people that practice medicine, the vast majority of them went in with a really beautiful intention, and the system and the mode of education kind of, you know, pops the balloon, so to speak. And I would bet that that if you that there are so many people out there who are ready to sort of stand by your side and support your efforts, and if only they knew that you were doing what you're doing, they would be right there.
Yeah. Thank you so much, Julia.
You're welcome.
Hey, Krupali. This is Gayatri here, and thank you so much for practicing true medicine. And that was such a fantastic advice that you gave, that you need to be a true advocate. And for me personally, I think I've been the fiercest advocate. Have not actually vaccinated my child, and even when we had to go for the a CT scan, I said I wanted to speak with another pediatrician, and the doctor that we were actually speaking with was kind of offended. He said, "Oh no, even I'm a pediatrician," you know. So yeah, it's probably it comes from the, you know, all this being a fierce advocate of being a fierce advocate. I guess it stems from a kind of disbelief, you know, in the practice of medicine that's, you know, as I see it now. So I wanted to know your thoughts on alternative medicine, what you think about it, and that would be great to hear. Yeah.
Well, I respect alternative medicine, but since I'm trained in the conventional approach, it's hard for me to sort of comment on the alternative stuff since I'm not as familiar, you know? I know that a lot of cancer patients that I've met have gone the alternative medicine route. Sometimes it really hasn't worked for them, depending on what modality, since there's, you know, the Indian stuff, there's stuff going on in Mexico. You know, I'm just respectful, but all I can advocate personally is just the traditional, the conventional approach.
Mm-hmm. Okay, thank you.
But I'm sure there's some truth to everything. I know in the cancer sphere, there are people who prey on people's emotions and their vulnerabilities and give them the wrong advice for financial gain. And I've seen that happen time and time again, you know. So that's sort of the downside sometimes when people prey on other people's vulnerabilities for financial gain, promising them a cure when there really isn't.
Okay.
So I've seen the good and the bad sides of it.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you
so much for being you. Yeah. Thank you.
You know, Kupala, this is Amit again. I had another question. While you were, you've obviously come across so many patients, and when you do have to break some very difficult news to them, you have to watch their families undergo this difficult time. And I guess, has your approach to even just providing compassion, providing a listening ear, changed over time? And I guess, do you have any sort of suggestions when individuals are come across that situation? Because I think that, you know, people feel naturally compassionate to individuals when they're going through this difficulty or when they have to break such difficult news, but the manner in which to handle that can sometimes be confusing, and sometimes it creates somewhat of an awkward situation. And so having had that experience time and time again, I guess, how has your sort of approach changed, and if you had any sort of tips, I guess, if you want to call it that?
Tips on what, breaking bad news or...
Yeah, I mean, some of it's that, but really more than anything, just providing support in that type of situation, just because oftentimes you're at a loss for words, or it almost feels like there is nothing that you can say that'll make someone feel better, that type of thing.
Well, I just hold people's hands a lot, and I hug people a lot, and I just let them speak. And I always let my patients know, whether it's good news or bad news, that I'm always there to either kick them in the pants or give them a hug. And it usually makes them laugh. All my patients and their family members, and I tell their family members that we have one patient in the room, not three or four, because I know the spouse or the caregiver also feels that an emotional loss. But I always tell the spouse that, you know, you need to eat and sleep because we're only taking care of one. And they understand that. And when I think holding people's hands while giving the news always helps. Letting them cry always helps, and giving them a hug always helps. It's just human connection.
I was just wondering if we as a community, what we can do to maybe help you not be under the radar, or anything else that you need, what we can do as a community to support you.
You know, I think this call was really supportive. I was very honored that Rahul asked me to speak. I think just helping others overall is supportive enough, whether it be in your community, doing the simple acts of kindness that you guys are doing in these service calls, which, I mean, this is a beautiful community. I didn't know everybody, I mean, all these people from around the globe are out there. It's nice to know that there's people who care, people who want to listen, and people who want to help. You know, if any of you are physicians or, you know, are in charge of putting together lectures or want me to speak, I'd be happy to, you know, share the stories. I've had the opportunity to share some of these stories that have come to fruition in several, you know, in different communities, whether I will, you know, at an arts foundation to I went to go speak to the engineers at Intel. And I kind of brought the stories together saying, you know, the technology that you have worked so hard to put together are helping people in this way, which made all these engineers cry, actually, which, you know, so they were like, oh, these are hardcore engineers. They're not going to understand your stories, but they did. Because I think connecting with humans and being kind to humans, it crosses all boundaries. It doesn't, you know, there's no profession that may not, you know, everybody will get touched in some way, shape, or form. And I think that's really beautiful to see, is that ripple effect. And so I just wanted to say thank you for allowing me to be here today. It means a lot.
Thank you so much. It's so interesting to see your spirit, Krupali, shines through your answer. I ask you what we can do to support you, and you tell us what you can do to support us. So that's beautiful. I think Birju had one question, too, before we close.
Yes. I just wanted to thank you again, Dr. Krupali, for taking this time out. And I feel like the big lesson that I learned today is even in the machine that forces us to try to conform, there's an opportunity to bring humanity into shift. I was wondering the impact that that process has had on you. If there was a meta reflection that you know you had to make to say, look, you know, I've been doing this for the last X period of time, how would you say that your own thinking has changed as a result of taking on these practices more and more in your daily life?
I think the biggest lesson I've learned is nothing is impossible. I've seen crazy dreams come together from the craziest, I mean, nothing is impossible, and that kindness does matter. A little kindness goes a long way.
Thank you.
Wow, beautiful.